Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life, conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Saints and Superheroes, a conversation about our modern fascination with superhero movies, comics, and what that means for ordinary Christian lives. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Ryan Gelliott.
Hello.
Artist, resident geek, and superhero fan.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this episode.
And I'm also joined from across the ocean by Mark Shea. Mark Shea is a convert, double jump convert, he says, from agnostic to evangelical to Catholic. He's a popular Catholic writer of such books as By What Authority, Making Sense Out of Scripture, Mary, Mother of the Son. We'll put those in the show notes. But today, his claim to fame is he is a fellow geek and enthusiast.
Nice.
Welcome, Mark.
Yes. Hello. Glad to be here.
Just a reminder for those, before we get stuck into this topic, because it's going to be hard to stop us, you can find the details about this podcast at thiscatholiclife.com.au. If you'd like to support us, you can subscribe to This Catholic Life on that website or on your favorite podcasting app. But most importantly, could you please consider dropping us a review? It's a written review on iTunes. It helps other people discover the podcast more easily and helps us to get the message out there. So let's dive right into today's topic, Saints and Superheroes. We should begin. Actually, I was going to begin with a definition, but let's start with what would your superpower be if you had to choose one? Off you go, get a box.
Well, I had a lot of conversations about this because there's so many superpowers out there that could actually also be abused.
Yeah.
And I think...
Couldn't they all be abused though?
Well, yes. But I mean, you know, invisibility and reading minds and mind control, that kind of... So I went with the safe option of actually super healing.
Ooh.
Being able to survive things.
Kind of like Wolverine?
Yeah. And also, you know, aging slowly.
You might already have this on the sly. Well, are you trying to come out here on the show? Box doesn't look his age. This is the whole thing. He's eternally youthful.
You know, I'm kind of old school. I think it would be cool to be able to fly.
Nice.
It's boring. It's generic. You know, but it's better than super strength. You know.
I used to dream a lot about having this gift of flying, which would fail intermittently, and that was the problem. That was the problem. You get up
there,
it's not working. was kind of weird. So I never had those falling dreams. I just had that one. Right. Well, what do we mean then by a superhero? Box over to the expert. What's the definition of a superhero?
Well, I think the first thing we need to look at, getting all technical, is defining superhero, separating that from the concept of hero.
Right.
Because a superhero is what I've come to understand, is a hero who has super abilities.
Right.
Something that makes them above and beyond what a typical human is. But then you've got humans who are heroes.
Right.
And the definition of hero these days, though, is thrown about quite loosely.
Yeah, I have to say I'm an Aussie rules supporter and I'm so sick. In fact, I almost wrote to the AFL recently because I'm so sick of every single headline being superhero player does this. And it's just because he happens to have kicked a ball more times than the other guys on the field. He's suddenly a superhero. Oh, no. Like, what? Really? Come on. We're overusing the word.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, that's... You don't want that.
Well, because the trouble with hyperbole is if you use it too much, you end up basically you've got no more words when you come across a real hero.
Mm. Yeah. There's a – what was it? Eddie Izzard is a comedian, and he was talking about the overuse of the word awesome.
Yes.
Yeah.
And somebody's talking about, you know, being on the International Space Station and you know, looking down on the Earth and saying – it's awesome. And somebody goes, do you mean awesome like a hot dog? And he goes, no, I mean awesome like 10,000 hot dogs.
we kind of lose the definition, don't we? Because we're using hyperbole, like the whole, you know, you see on Facebook all the time, best coffee ever. Really? Really? Have you actually gone to all the other coffees and checked them out? Or is just this, you're just saying, I appreciate this particular coffee, you know?
Yeah, yeah. We have, in Seattle, we have Seattle's best coffee. That's the real place. And yeah. This is the city that gave the world Starbucks. So,
well, it's a big claim, you know, Mark. I've been to the US and I've tasted the coffee there. I'm not. I haven't been to Seattle, so you're gonna have a lot of convincing.
Okay.
Yeah.
You gotta come. You know, I can take you to Starbucks number one. It's like a shrine.
See, you just said coffee and Starbucks in the same sentence.
I know.
So computing.
It's like we also gave the world Microsoft, you know, which is pretty good. Please be gentle.
I've always thought that a modern superhero would have something to do with that. All right. Yeah. Now, coming back to the superhero theme, let's be honest, Box, you've spent more than a little time on this topic over the years.
Yeah, I almost would say it was a wasted young adulthood, but no, it's become more and more relevant these days, I think.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It used to be geekery, didn't it? It used to be that only the sort of the fringe people were interested in this.
And now it's the people that can afford those, you know, superhero sculptures and things. They got the high-paying jobs, you know. The geeks rule the world now. But I gave a talk on this actually about a year or so ago. And one of the things I found out when I was preparing for the talk was in conjunction with the Disney Princess, the concept, you know, 1937 was the first Disney Princess movie, which I think might have been Cinderella.
Okay.
No, it was Snow White.
No, Snow White. Ooh, okay, thank you. Yeah. And then we had Superman in 1938, but before that we had the Phantom. So you have a hero and a superhero.
Right.
And this is all about the time just before, you know, World War II, the big thing that happened in the world. And what I found interesting was the stories of superheroes since then seem to correlate with certain things that happen in the world, certain dark periods.
So when there's dark periods and profound destruction and evil versus kind of the rest of us.
I mean, and then you get this really interesting period in the mid 80s to 90s with the rise of anti-heroes that seem to parallel an almost deconstructivism we have in society, you know, with shows like Seinfeld and things like that. So there's this really interesting journey of superheroes that parallels our journey in life. Now, you know, correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation, but what an interesting thing is there is that superheroes is one of the last bastions, I guess, of storytelling that we still teach or still have morality, at least as some kind of point.
When I was a boy, you used to watch the old Western, you know, the good guy versus the bad guy kind of thing. And the good guy stands off and you could tell he was the good guy because he wore a white hat, you know, and the bad guys all had black hats, you know, and the good guy shot the bad guy at the end and you knew he was going to walk away into the sunset kind of thing. But interesting, I want to perhaps come back to that anti-hero idea there, because there seems to have been a kind of a desire to paint the superheroes out as flawed heroes, as if there's some sort of flaw. And in many cases, the bad guy in the movies is actually a superhero who's just got become obsessed with something or you know, is going using his powers for evil kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, in most of the movies that I'm thinking of, the bad guys in the movie or the tension is between different superheroes. Mm. Yeah, there's two different kinds of superheroes going head to head. What do you think, Mark? Are we missing something in terms of the development of superheroes?
Well, I'm no expert. When I was growing up, I was a DC kid, which I deeply regret now because I hate.
Is this one of your double jump conversions that you converted to Marvel?
I'm much more fond of the Marvel heroes. Mm. Well, if you ever get Steven Gradonis on the show, he has far more advanced. He's given this a lot more thought than I have. And, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong here, but one of the things that he argues is that the Marvel universe is a much more Christian universe than the DC universe. The DC universe is a universe of kind of pagan gods. And I, when I was growing up, Superman was my guy. That was right. I was the Superman, and the Superman that I remember, as I look back now, there's the fact that a whole website that's devoted to this, simply the thesis that Superman is really kind of a jerk.
Yep. I saw that.
So he's like, he's always doing these, you know, playing these jerk pranks on people and stuff like this, and it's like, yeah, that's actually true, you know. But the Marvel universe is a universe of flawed humans, not demigods.
Yeah,
they have these superpowers, but you know, Spider-Man is he's this teenage kid who has, you know, romance problems, and he's got to get his homework in, and you know, the boss is mad at him because of this and that and the other thing, and you know, Superman doesn't have those problems.
Oh, he has deadlines, doesn't he? Because he's a news reporter.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know.
I'm going to push you on this because I mean, I prefer the movies possibly because of the way they're directed and put together. But to be honest, looking at the heroes, I would say in terms of bad guys and the actual plot that is actually worked out, I would say the DC movies tend to have more colorful and interesting, if a little bit more stylized bad guys, and they've sort of filled that out. And I'm much more interested in the bad guys in the DC universe because they seem to sort of shape the movies. Whereas the Marvel universe, the bad guys are almost just a backdrop for the key superheroes to play out. And most of the tension seems to be between the heroes themselves or the dialogue. Box, you're nodding away there thinking.
It's interesting because we're looking at storytelling, and I think the idea, the concept of superheroes is a very ancient one, I would say. I mean, if you look at the ancient Greek dramas and things like that, the concept of gods and demigods.
Yep.
And a lot of people will go attend these plays for a type of catharsis, you know. And I think one of the things that in storytelling of the early comics, at least in Marvel comics, was, you know, this is the hero, but without that moral standing, what would have happened? I think they would explore through the villains what could have happened to the heroes.
Right.
And I think there's a real depth of story that could happen there, depending on how creative you are.
It's like Lord of the Rings with the ring. Everyone gets challenged by the ring. Yeah. Even the good guys have to sort of answer the call.
But I think it's interesting because lately, in the last decade or so, Marvel's gone more and more away from that, at least in the comics. And you almost have to keep creating different villains then. You're no longer exploring, you know, the hero through a villain. But you have to keep creating villains in order to keep challenging the hero.
Right. And getting bigger and bigger villains.
Yeah. And it's just, it's interesting.
That's an interesting question. I've seen a lot of debate online about this, about whether Thanos was a suitable enough villain for the ending of the Marvel calling it the first arc. How many movies is it?
23.
23 movies, and they call it the first arc.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
The Infinity Saga.
Yes, I'm afraid I have superhero exhaustion after that particular movie went through.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
But I mean, coming back to the DC universe, I mean, looking at the whole the trilogy, is it the Nolan trilogy of the
Batman?
The Batman ones.
Yeah.
That you couldn't. And they're so Christ-like in the sense of Batman's self-sacrifice. Now, there's lots of flaws in the analogy, but it's very much that he takes on, if you like, the guilt in order to save the whole community. Right. But also, more importantly, and we actually use this in our university, Mark, is that we used to use the image of the Joker as an image of Satan, not because he's particularly evil himself, but because he draws people into making decisions over against each other. Like he gets...
Yeah,
he tries to make you make a decision between two evils as if this would be a good thing.
Right.
And the redemption actually comes from the least likely source. It's really interesting, that particular analogy. I would say it's in some respects more clearly Christian in that sense. Yeah. Then you get to Suicide Squad, and who the heck knows what's going on there?
Yeah. Does it anyway?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I loathe the work of Zack Snyder. And I loathe what he's done with Superman. It's funny because in a lot of ways, Christopher Nolan, especially the Joker, Christopher Nolan's villain is every bit as nihilist as everything that Zack Snyder does all the time, always.
Right. Here's a taste.
But the thing is that it's the Joker who's a nihilist. It's not Batman.
Yeah, and his philosophy is perfectly expressed in contrast with Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I thought Nolan's vision of the Joker really is, it's one of the most satanic visions of evil I think I've ever seen.
Mm.
I thought that Heath Ledger, he's your countryman too, by the way, and I thought he did an incredibly great job in that role.
Mm.
But I can also see how I think it's got to be toxic to the soul to play a role like that.
Yeah.
It's got to be hard.
Yep. Yep.
You know, I mean, it's the work of an artist to do things like that. And so, you know, God rest his soul. But that vision of evil, I think, really stands out from anything that Marvel has done.
Yeah.
And so that I will call a really great work of art. I think it is.
Yeah.
Most of the DC universe, things like Suicide Squad, it's like, why are we watching this again? I
mean, it was entertaining and bang, 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 whiz, you know, that kind of thing.
But, yeah, I guess.
But let me throw another one in there. Why is it that Marvel and DC in particular have taken off? And I'm also getting some kinds of other comics, like there's the Dark Horse comics and there's other sort of comic things. They don't seem to have the same grab now. Is it just an accident of circumstances?
I haven't read all of the Dark Horse Marvel and DC comics, obviously, but I mean, I think Dark Horse does focus more on the concept of anti-heroes.
Right.
And I think Marvel and DC, at least originally, opened up and really accepted and embraced the concept of this fantasy of the superhero. And Superman himself is a Moses figure.
Right.
Yeah, you know, he's
just unpack that a little bit for
us. Well, I mean, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster are the guys that made Superman.
Okay.
Two Jewish men who wanted to present hope.
Right.
At a particular time. Yeah. And so, you know,
that time was?
It was around the time of, well, after World War One.
Okay,
there's already
a kind of a danger there, isn't there, from the Nazi regime and the people who are blaming Jews for things and
And so you have this concept of a man who's saved from destruction in an ark, so to speak, comes to another place to be the Superman and be a savior there, and we've adapted it now later on as a Christian figure as well.
Yeah. Especially in the first Superman film.
Yeah.
You literally have this, you know, Christological introduction, you know, where Superman's father, Jor-El, is sort of giving this, he gives this speech that's on playback that Kal-El goes, Kal-El is Superman's real name.
Mm.
And he says, you know, Earth, you know, the Earth people need someone to guide them and help them, and so I'm sending them you, my only begotten son.
Oh dear!
And it's like, okay, you know, I think I get where this is going. You know,
it's almost C.S. Lewis, and it's
especially if you watch.
No, go ahead.
Well, especially if you watch the extended edition. An extended version of that movie where they have so much dialogue setting up the world building, I guess you could say.
Mm.
And it really puts that, as Mark was saying.
Yeah. There's a book by a Jewish author talking about the Jewish origin of the comics.
Right.
It's called, brilliantly, it's called Up, Up, and Oy Vey.
Nice.
And this is a theme that was recently touched on by another Jewish comic author, a guy named Art Spiegelman.
All right.
Who's most famous. He won a Pulitzer for his comic series Mouse.
Yep. Oh, wow.
Which is his sort of comic book version of the stories that he heard from his own father about surviving the Holocaust.
Oh, wow.
It's a harrowing read. And in it, of course, the Jews are mice and the Nazis are cats. And he wrote an essay recently which did not wind. He eventually withdrew it from publication because they wanted him to change it, and he refused to change it. And his thesis was that the comics were in huge part were a response to the rise of fascism by the Jewish imagination in the United States.
Right.
Looking at the rise of the Nazis, looking at the rise of Mussolini and so forth. And so, you know, I mean, we've all seen, for example, the pictures of Captain America decking Hitler.
Yeah.
You know? And Captain America was 100% was, you know, written to, you know, bolster Allied morale during World War II.
So they kind of play on that in the first Captain America movie, don't they?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And but, you know, you also see this with Superman. Superman is first released in 1938. So the Nazis are on the rise. But in, you know, during World War II, he comes into his own. You can watch old Max Fleischer cartoons where it's, you know, Superman and Girl Reporter, Lois Lane, you know, breaking the Nazi spy ring, and the radio show is, you can listen to the Superman radio shows where that's, you know, the villains are Nazis.
Now, can I just pin you on that for a sec? Because, and also Ryan, the whole idea of the Nazis being this super villain thing, we see it as, well, it's been done to death. You know, there's the whole, what's that principle that if you're on the internet for more than 10 minutes, someone calls you a Nazi? What's that one?
Godwin's law.
Godwin's law, yeah. So there's a limited amount of time in any argument before someone calls someone else Hitler or a Nazi or something.
Right.
And it's become sort of the icon of evil. But 1938 is where there were still people saying, oh, no, you're overstating the case. It's not that bad, you know. And what they're seeing there isn't what we've seen as the end result. They're seeing the danger and then putting it into black and white, literally, in cartoon form, so that we can see beyond, you know, sort of the murky circumstances into the reality of the evil involved. Is that a fair comment, you reckon, Box?
Yeah. I mean, I think it helps with the argumentation and bringing it to a social audience to look at things, because we can muddy up the waters, I guess, in certain argumentations. And to look at the core, you know, tenets of what does this say, what, you know.
Yeah, and regardless of what people's intentions in getting excited about the revival of Germany in 1938, they're pointing to where this ideology leads.
Yeah.
And now given that, and this is why I wanted to pull you up on it, Mark, not against you, but just simply address this particular issue, is if the superheroes and the comics are addressing that, if they're calling into light, if you like, in an artistic form, the dangers of these ideologies, what does it say about us that our superheroes almost always have to be these flawed kind of mixed up people who get a bit wrong and get a bit right, and we're almost against the sort of icon of goodness, you know?
Well, I think that it's just the dramatic impulse. You know, if a character with flaws is more interesting, and that's it.
Okay.
And so if you're going to tell story, that was, you know, Stan Lee decided that when he created Spider-Man, he wanted him to have all these problems, you know, and so, you know, it's girl trouble and it's a school and, you know, and he's, and of course, being a good Jewish boy, he's racked with guilt because he, you know, I killed my uncle because I didn't stop the bad guy, you know, but with those flaws then comes his whole struggle to live out. With great power comes great responsibility.
Right. Yeah.
And so just if you're going to write drama, which is, that is, you know, Stan Lee was a frustrated novelist. He dreamt of being a novelist his whole life and instead wound up doing comics and felt like this is all I'm doing is just these worthless comics. Well, you know, it turns out that he was practically the inventor of this massive genre. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally. Okay, sure. DC was doing it as well, and there were other comics. But we owe such a colossal debt to Stan Lee, and the reason that we do is because he realized that characters with flaws are more interesting, and this is the basic principle of Greek drama.
Yeah, I think that was really interesting because, I mean, when Stan Lee created Iron Man, his whole purpose was to get an unlikable hero to be likable. You know, someone you couldn't really relate to because how many millionaires were out there? How many, you know, rich, you know, money-making people? And
a billionaire who cares about other people. Yeah, there's a stand-up.
Yeah, he did. And then you've got Captain America, the man out of time.
Right.
You had the Hulk, a man who has anger issues. You had Spider-Man who, he was told that Spider-Man was not to be printed because no one likes spiders and no one could relate to teenagers. It wasn't until Timely Comics at the time was going under. They were believed it was going to be the last print, and someone just said to him, you know, just give it a shot, put Spider-Man in there, and it saved the comic book companies.
Yeah.
And suddenly there was Marvel Comics. And you see that start to translate to DC, where they started focusing on the flaws of the heroes, the things that can make them more human. So Superman suddenly is the last son of Krypton. You had Batman is suddenly the real persona, and Bruce Wayne is the fake, the mask, you know. And so it is that conflict, inner and outer conflict, and the struggle to be good despite and because of the conflict.
Well, yeah. There's at least one essay I've read, because I'm in sexuality and gender studies area, that Wonder Woman was created by a person who had a very unhealthy view of women and wanted to constantly get her captured by people so that they could live out this fantasy of capture. I'm intrigued by that because the way it's played out in history, like as Wonder Woman's developed, especially the more recent movies, you wouldn't call her a victim in any sense. And so in a sense, she's actually, it's almost, if that was his intention, if that was what it was, and certainly it seems so when you look at some of the earlier stuff, then it seems to have, you know, demonstrated that the development of our society's understanding of the woman hero.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in the Marvel universe, what the women heroes, I think they're great, but they're not at the front of the action, so to speak. You know, they're kind of as part of a montage. So I'm kind of looking forward to the Black Widow one, although that might be a little dark.
Yeah.
What's one of the things that's always been interesting to me is the figure of Lois Lane in the Superman universe, because Lois was always, you know, plucky. And she comes out of kind of a movie trope. I don't know if you're familiar with The Front Page and His Girl Friday and the whole, you know, gutsy girl reporter. You know, she's never called a woman reporter in those days. She's always a girl reporter. But she's totally, she can take care of herself. And in the comics, a lot of times Lois is kind of thick sometimes, you know. I mean, she's super thick because she never figures out that Clark Kent is Superman, you know.
Well, that kind of adds to the narrative, don't they? I mean, you can't resolve that, otherwise the whole narrative changes.
Developed that now, that he had some latent telepathic abilities that help people to not recognize him.
The fact that a pair of glasses suddenly radically changes his identity so dramatically that no one can see who it is.
Who are you?
You want to know something interesting? You know where that comes from? There's an actual origin for this.
Okay.
There was a silent film star. There were three great silent film star comedians, Charlie Chaplin.
Yep.
Buster Keaton,
okay.
And the third one was Harold Lloyd.
Uh-huh.
And if you've ever seen the picture of the guy hanging off the clock face in the, you know, the silent picture of a guy hanging off the face of a clock on some skyscraper, that's Harold Lloyd.
Okay.
Now, the thing is Harold Lloyd's character always has on a big round pair of glasses. So he's this kind of dweeby guy, right? Well, Harold Lloyd discovered that if he took the glasses off, he could go anywhere he wanted in the United States and nobody recognized him. And that's where they got that conceit from.
Right.
Was Harold Lloyd's glasses.
Mm.
It's just kind of this weird thing, you know?
Yeah, I wonder, though, that if it works the other way, because I think if you're used to seeing someone with glasses and then they're not with them, it would have a different effect than them putting on a pair of glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know.
What about other superheroes? Box?
Well, I mean, you have, I think, in recent times, I'm going back to that concept of anti-hero.
Right.
The development of that that thought of a very human hero, I think, goes down a particularly dark path there.
Right.
And it resulted in Watchmen, you know, the old comic book series. And the line there, and they've been revived recently in DC Comics, but the line there is, who watches the Watchmen? Who patrols the superheroes?
And that came up in the latest, in the Avengers story arc, didn't it? Who's going to look out for and control the Avengers themselves?
Yeah. And the Superhero Registration Act and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think recently with The Boys on Amazon, I think, so there's this whole development of thought, and that's where you get anti-hero, which is, you know, a person who doesn't fit the classical understanding of a hero or a superhero, but still seems to do some kind of good. But
yeah.
I mean, down that line, you could almost argue that Kingpin from the Daredevil Netflix series is an anti-hero and
very
not a
much
villain.
So, yeah, you know, he's scary, but scary because he's believable in many respects.
Yeah, and a lot of people feel sympathy for him.
That was, by the way, one of the more Catholic series I've seen. I mean, the fact that Daredevil goes to confession, and it's one of the only movies where I've seen confession actually done like it's supposed to be done, because he tries to confess something he's about to do and the priest goes, that's not how it works. He comes out and talks him through it. It's quite a good take. Coming back to that, though, the whole anti-hero thing, what about, I know this hasn't hit the films, but in the comic Marvel series, Captain America turns into having been a secret Hydra plant.
There was a whole mind
all along.
Yeah, there's a whole mind thing there with one of the soul gem or some kind of infinity stone, and they end up having to summon the real Captain America to come back and defeat the evil Captain America. It caused a huge disruption when he proclaims on the last page of one of his comic books, "Hail Hydra."
You know, I joined the Knights of Columbus.
Right.
It's an American Catholic organization. I don't think they've got the Knights in Australia, right?
Yeah, just for the listener, just to be clear, we're not talking about superheroes now. These are real people.
That's right. So there's this Catholic organization that they started in the United States in the 19th century. The thing was you had a gazillion Italian immigrants coming into the United States. And so Father McGivney looked at them and said, we need some way to welcome Italians into the American church. What's some connection that we can make to America? Well, there weren't a lot of Italians in the Second Continental Congress. So they said, I'm Columbus, that's it, right? So they started the Knights of
Columbus. So, Mark, here we have this Knights of the Southern Cross. And they were formed mostly because in the 1950s, even as late as the 1950s, it wasn't uncommon to have in newspapers, Catholics need not apply for jobs. So basically, people who didn't like the Catholics because they were the immigrants from a poorer background would simply exclude them from jobs. And so the Knights of the Southern Cross were formed almost completely to provide support and community and jobs for Catholics.
Okay.
And they still exist here in Sydney, although the need for it has waned recently. It's growing again.
Yeah. Well, the Knights of Columbus was formed at a time when Americans in particular were fascinated with secret societies. 19th century, just they went nuts for secret societies here in the U.S. And so, and you know, some of them were okay, and some of them were like the Ku Klux Klan,
So everyone wants to know, Mark, have you learned the secret handshake of the Columbus Knights?
Well, so here's the thing. I got this friend who was like, you know, he wanted to see if I would join the Knights. So I finally thought, I want to do something to like help out with the Oktoberfest and the yep. pancake breakfast. And
right.
that's really was all my interest. Yeah. Right.
So it's good to see so they're tackling the big issues. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I said, okay, so I'll join the Knights. So I went to the Knights. Well, the thing is when you join the Knights, because it was created in the late 19th century when everybody was gaga for secret societies, they've got all these, you know, little rituals and handshakes and, you know, you get in line and you go to the big oak doors at the hall and somebody knocks on the door three times and somebody else says, you know, who goes there? You know, it was just, I thought it was hilarious, right? I was just, it was so funny. And so I went through the whole thing and you get the special oaths and do you swear that you will never reveal what happens here? You know, unless it's a good reason, like if you're in court or something. It's like, and so you do that and then it's like, okay, now let's talk about insurance. And it was so funny. So I went to this thing and did the little, you know, ritual that you do to enter the Knights, which just killed me. And I came to Mass the next day because it was on a Saturday evening. And this friend of mine comes up to me and says, so, how'd it go? So I shook his hand and I leaned in to his ear and said, Hail Hydra. So, yeah.
Hopefully
so
he got the joke. But
oh, yeah, absolutely. He thought it was hilarious. You know. Yeah.
What about this is kind of the whole idea of there being a secret thing and there being consequences and then going straight to the insurance reminded me of The Incredibles, because The Incredibles is kind of a really interesting slant on the superhero thing that they get right mm-hmm. at the start of the movie. They get sued for the damages of a superhero. And then we saw it played out in one of the Avengers movies that they was it the Civil War or something like that, where they actually had a big complaint against them because they did all this damage.
Yeah. Right.
It's an interesting thing because it's kind of bringing the modern sort of restrictiveness of legislative behavior and regulation into the superhero sphere.
Yeah.
You look like
And it's asking the same kind of question that the DC comics are asking, about Superman is – you know, I mean, Superman's always been the super good guy and incredibly virtuous and a total Boy Scout. But it's like, yeah, but he does have the capacity to destroy the world if he wanted to.
Well, the last about 30 minutes of every Superman movie I've seen recently has been huge buildings falling down because he's, you know, I'm saving the world. Yeah, but you just took out half of it.
What's interesting is in the Justice League stories in DC, Batman created the contingency plan for every superhero in the Justice League.
Ah.
So if any of them were to go rogue, the contingency plan would activate and Batman knew how to take them down.
Right.
When the other leaguers found out about this, there was almost like a trial against Batman. And Batman had to say, look, if any of you went rogue, we're dealing with a super threat, basically.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Superman said, well, what happens if you go rogue? And he said, and basically the indication was, well, I'm a guy. I'm a rich guy. I'm smart, but you're all superheroes. it's an interesting.
Yeah. You catch me on the toilet and I'm stuffed.
I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's, I think that, you know, one of the things that you see there, of course, is a reflection of the crash in confidence about modernity and about, and certainly, about American virtue.
Yeah.
I mean,
is it believable that a single individual could be, in fact, virtuous consistently?
Right. And, you know, Superman is, you know, he was the embodiment, you know, in the 40s and 50s, he was the embodiment of truth, justice, and the American way. And all of those things were synonyms for Americans at that time. And there's been ever since the late 60s, there was a huge crisis of morale that is still with us. And you see it I mean, you see it with a rallying cry like "Make America Great Again."
So there's the impression that, whatever we think about that particular movement, there's the the impression being given we have fallen somehow from greatness, and we need to get back to something great.
Yeah, we have to return, and that's you get that sort of return to Eden kind of thing, And one of the things that the Christian
We have it in Australia with the Anzac legend that this is kind of idealization. Yeah. I mean, it's almost the only thing we have because we're a very short history here, but the idealization of the Australian participation in World War One and Two, the Anzac kind of spirit and the Anzac and the mateship of the soldiers and the self-sacrificial nature. And when you actually go back and look at the history of it, the Australians had a higher desertion rate, a higher problematic rate than the British troops in the same areas. But the image that was sent home, the kind of the media image of the Australian troops was quite deliberately cultivated in order to try and encourage this. And what's interesting is a lot of Australians still identify that as, an identity of Australian mateship, this Anzac idea. And now even what's interesting is our troops now hold it up as their ideal that they try and live up to. I don't know how successful they are, but they're actually trying, they list it, whereas it never actually existed. And so when we say, let's get back to the Anzac spirit, you're thinking, well, let's just be honest about this. We have an ideal we're shooting for. It's not, going back in time is not going to find the ideal any more than going anywhere else. So,
yeah. And I think that there is, though, there's a kind of, with nations have creation myths. They do.
Right.
And those things are not necessarily bad. They can call great things out of us.
Right.
But at the same time, it's important to remember that they are myths. And, when we speak here in the United States about making America great again, what do we mean by that? Well, right now what we mean by that is we need to return to separate water fountains. It's like, that's not greatness,
No, no.
That's bad,
Yeah.
And so we have to be careful about our myths and how we use our myths. And the whole notion that you can get back to Eden is something that the tradition very helpfully categorically denies as possible.
Also, if we can push this a little harder and say one of the things about setting up these superheroes and making them anti-heroes is that we're not idealizing the part of the hero that is flawed. Mm. We're still saying that a flawed person can, in fact, be a hero.
Yeah. Yes.
And this is something I want to sort of link it here. The title of the show was Saints and Superheroes. This idea of idealizing someone as a paragon of a particular virtue is as old as the saints. I mean, we're looking at people who are definitely flawed. I think our own Bishop Fisher, on the day of his installation, gave a speech which included I'm now one of the apostles, which included several fishermen, a tax collector, some very angry men and a traitor, and God only knows which one of these I will best emulate, And the point being is that these are all very ordinary, very flawed people, and yet they exhibited, through Christ's grace, they exhibited some amazing virtue. How much is this linked? Is it too much to say that superheroes are a kind of a modern attempt to create what we have in saints, or is there enough difference to identify?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that we are a monkey see, monkey do species. This is how we learn.
Right. By stories or by example specifically?
By stories and by examples. And that's what heroes do for us at their best. They show us that it can be done. And this is one of the reasons that I agree with Stephen Gerdanis's remark about Marvel heroes in particular. Are, if you will, they're more Catholic because they're Superman is literally invulnerable.
Right.
I mean, nothing can hurt Superman ultimately, and he always wins. And he's the Marvel heroes are like Catholic saints in that Catholic saints are they're screw ups. I mean, you know, look at Peter. I mean, I love Peter because he's such a screw up all the time, you know, and becoming a Christian doesn't remove that from him.
No. Jerome is my favorite saint, partially because actually my favorite is Saint Albert the Great, but Jerome is one of my favorites because he's such a grumpy fellow that he couldn't get along with anyone in the ancient world. Like, he joined almost every religious community that existed, and it just didn't work out for any of
right.
them. And so his yes. sainthood came about when the Pope finally said, look, just go and sit in a room by yourself and translate the Bible, okay? Just do something like that. And because this brought out the best in him, he made it to sainthood. He gives me great hope. So
yeah.
Now, Box, yep. You look like you had something to say about saints and superheroes.
Oh, no. I remember learning about Blessed Miguel Pro.
Okay.
And just finding him very interesting because it was a time when Christianity, Catholicism was not accepted in the country.
Which country?
South America.
Mexico.
Yep. Mexico. Yeah. Yep.
Sorry, yeah. Mexico. And what happened was that he would be very, I guess, theatrical.
Right.
in what he was doing. And one of the stories that I just remembered when you were speaking was that he was, I think, celebrating Mass or something in a house, and the police stormed the house looking for him. He ended up getting out, dressing like a police officer, walking back into the house, making a comment, something along the lines of, we'll get that Miguel, and then walking off. And I just thought that was hilarious.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I could be wrong, but that's one of the stories I remember hearing about.
Lovely.
And there's
a story like that about Athanasius.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Athanasius was taken in on the lam. He was exiled from his see 5 times. And at one point, he was on a boat coming down the Nile when imperial troops searching for him were coming up the Nile. And they shouted to his boat and said, have you seen Athanasius? And he said, he's not far from here. sailed past them. So, yeah, that's
pretty
awesome.
Really cool stories. But one of the things you said before is that the flawed saint thing is not a new thing. But we don't listen to, for example, St. Augustine's story where he talks about his childhood and in particular he talks about this incident of stealing some peaches, I think it is, from a tree, or some fruit from a tree. We don't go, all right, well then it's cool to steal peaches, or you know, or we can go. You know, this is the step to Christianity. First, you have to steal peaches. Then we're talking about showing that a flawed person can actually come out and become mm-hmm. virtuous by God's grace.
Yeah.
Are we missing out a little bit by not like the saint story thing? Hasn't been as prominent, I would say, in our modern catechesis and our modern churches as it could be. Mm. Sometimes we can get a little bit too excited about it, and I'm getting a little bit tired of seeing these, oh, pray this infallible novena to Saint Vitellone or of what you call it. Don't look that one up, people who are listening. I made that up. But basically, that when we overstate the influence of a saint's, however, there's something, there's power in a story, and we're seeing this in the superhero stories. Mm. There's power in a story. It grabs our imagination in a way that just telling people, hey, being a nice guy is a good idea. When you actually put it into a story and a saint who's lived it out, like Saint Nicholas, who you know, the legend of him tossing gifts into the window of the poor people's houses so that they don't know who gave it to them. And that sort of thing. I mean, it really grabs our imagination, draws us in.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think there's no reason we couldn't return to that, and that we should. I think it's a sadness to me that there are some just awesome saint stories, some real Lulus. Mm-hmm. There's the Saint Callistus, who was this slave who, like, you know, fleeced his master's servants on some investment scheme, and and eventually they just, you know, his master said, I have had enough of you, and sent him to the salt mines, where that's where he became a Christian.
Right.
And he wound up coming back to Rome, and he eventually wound up as Pope. You know, and it's just like, okay, you know, and if I'm not mistaken, because of his checkered past, we wound up with the first anti-pope in history, a guy named Hippolytus.
Oh, wow.
And Hippolytus becomes an anti-pope. There's a persecution that breaks out. Both Callistus and Hippolytus wind up being sentenced again to the salt mines, where they were reconciled and died. And Hippolytus is a saint in the Roman calendar, despite having been an anti-pope. That's a lulu of a story. That's an incredible story.
That's an amazing
story. Oh, absolutely. It'd make a great story. You know, and it's a shame that we don't hear those stories anymore because, yeah, just fascinating characters.
That was one of the I don't mean to mention it, but there's been several unmentionable attempts to rewrite Catholic history and make some sort of massive conspiracy theory out of the whole church story. My main anger at that is that you're missing all of the really cool, messy history that's there, and the fact that it demonstrates that it is only by God's grace that the church still exists at all.
Well, I think, look, I remember in the 90s on a trip to the Philippines finding a St. Peter comic.
Oh, really?
And I realized that the Marvel Comics also released, I think, a series on St. Francis, and there were a few other comic books of saints. But I think the problem is the focus, what conflict is focused on. And with the superheroes, it's so easy to believe in these fantastic stories of conflict with this or that, and the themes are usually solidified within a personification.
Yeah.
With the Catholic comics, and I think they would make fantastic episodic stories, like the Hulk.
Right.
But oftentimes, as you said, Peter, people like to spin it.
Right.
And they'll put a focus on something that's very attractive.
Yep.
But then you lose out on what's actually, you know, the long long play of what the real thing is.
The other thing is, as soon as you said they've done a comic series on Francis, I started cringing, not because of the series, but because every time I've seen Christians try to do a sort of a sanitized version of a Christian history, it always looks cringeworthily sort of glossy and ugh. And so one of them, my favorite, absolute favorite for inducing my gag reflex, is the Captain Bible sort of this superhero who quotes scriptures at his enemies and they all fall down. And he's, oh my goodness, could you get a less appealing sort of parody of stupidity? It's almost as if, I mean, I find more inspiration in some of the very flawed portrayals of superheroes, precisely not because of the flaws, but precisely because they're realistic enough to believe in.
Well, there was a comic book hero called Battle Pope.
Oh no.
And it was look, I never read an issue, but there was I've seen a lot of covers called Battle Pope.
wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So I wouldn't be able to tell you much about the details, but I just remember him. He had, you know, the whole full regalia on.
I'm gonna have nightmares about this now. This is just his mitre's got a rocket launcher on the bottom.
He was
of it
huge too. This guy could give Thor a run for his money. And this guy was huge.
Battle Pope.
Yeah, look it up. And I'm sorry.
Amazing.
See, one of my favorite lines from the Marvel Universe is that there's only one God, ma'am, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't dress like that.
Yes. Yep, that's a great line.
All right. Well, perhaps maybe we should, since I've used that as a good line, do you have a favorite superhero line to kind of wrap up? Go ahead, Mark.
Superhero line. Wow. You, Ryan.
You're both throwing to each other.
We might need a bit of time.
We have some think time.
Well, that's actually one of my favorites right there is that one.
Right.
I'm kind of blanking on it. I have to think about it.
That's my favorite one, but there's another one where Captain America and Iron Man are arguing about whether or not they should sign up to this whole idea of a legislative oversight of the superheroes. And and Captain America is more or less saying, isn't the whole point of a superhero is that when the legislative framework and all the normal ways have failed, and we're not part of the system, we just happen to be a more powerful warhead or something. We're actually kind of a check and balance on the system. And it reminded me of the whole church versus state thing in the ancient Hebrew setup, that the prophets, the prophets who worked for the king very rarely told the king he was doing the wrong thing.
Right.
But the prophets who are outside of the system, who were very fearless in their condemnation of the king, often suffered for it, but they were the ones that were actually effective in their critique. Yeah. That was, I thought, a really interesting image.
There's actually...
Although, what is also interesting about the prophets is that the prophets, with rare exceptions, have no power. So, I mean, you know, Elijah.
One of them was it? Which one was the one that called the bear down on the people?
Well, yeah, there was Elisha, and you know, Elijah, you know, calls down fire from heaven and so forth. But Elijah sticks out in that he's one of the few prophets that doesn't get killed in a gruesome way.
Yeah, and he has a pretty cool ending too. I mean, he could be a superhero. Chariot of fire and all that, you know.
Chariot of fire, the whole thing, yeah. But he's the exception to the rule. Most of them wind up getting sawed in two or thrown down a well or, you know, beheaded or, you know. And that's interesting that Elijah is, he's sort of the proto-prophet. He's the one that, you know, that when Jesus appears on the Mount of Transfiguration and Elijah is the one that's there, but it's the other prophets don't get the retirement benefits that Elijah got. So,
there's this great line in Captain America Civil War, actually, just talking about lines that I think this will have to be just off the top of my head on. But, Sharon Carter says it in the movies, but in the comics, almost line by word for word, it's said by Captain America to someone else. And it goes along the lines of, when the world is telling you to move, it's your job to plant your feet like a tree and tell the world, no, you move.
Ooh.
And this whole concept of being strong in the ideals that you stand for and defend. And it's a really interesting challenge, I think, for Christians, for Catholics.
Yeah, majority doesn't tell you what's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Well, I think, is it Augustine who said good is good even if no one's doing it and evil is evil even if everyone's doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that probably is a good place to wrap it up. It's time for our 1 minute wonder. So we perhaps haven't seen a superhero, but maybe something that made us wonder. I'll start with you, Mark.
Well, let's see. A 1 minute wonder. I got to see all my grandchildren on Sunday.
Wow.
And they were just a joy, you know, and it was very simple things because they're little, you know, but my 3-year-old granddaughter Charlotte was we have a wooden boat in the backyard for kids to play in. And so she was climbing on the Mystifer and then leaping off, and that, which was, I must confess, it was quite impressive, especially given her tiny size. And then she would run over and give me a huge hug and then climb up in the Mystifer again and leap off and then run over and give me a hug. It was glorious. What a great way to spend a Sunday.
Yes, indeed. So. Box.
Actually, this podcast got me remembering a line that an old mentor told me, that he said, if the original apostles were alive today, with the drive and fervor they had to outreach and bring Christianity out to everyone else, what would the world look like? And that makes you think, what am I doing? Am I living that, I guess, that life of sharing the faith? Am I being a superhero, so to speak, you know?
Cool. I have been rereading Sherry Waddell's book, Forming Intentional Disciples, because of her visit to Australia. And I have to say that her challenge, and if you like, she calls her turning point in understanding how to develop discipleship in parishes, when she asks someone the question, can you tell me about your personal relationship with Christ? And she notes in her book that this is not a question that's asked frequently of Catholics. And it occurred to me, it's not even a question I ask myself frequently, and come back to that, all right, where do I stand with Christ? Not just where do I stand in terms of the objective judgment and all those sorts of things, but have I actually been talking to him, and have I been listening back, and do, you know, have we got a friendship, and have I invested in this friendship? And clearly he's invested in me, but have I invested in that friendship? And pretty much lots of things that I'm blaming on God, and God, if you just help me with this or that or the other, you know, maybe I could drop in and have a chat sometime and get back to that relationship. So that's my 1 minute wonder. It shouldn't be one something that it surprised me, but it's a constant reminder we need for that one. All right, that's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with your podcast device, let us know. If we missed a superhero, bring it up. The show notes, Mike, for this one are going to be so huge. We've got so many things that we've just dropped in there as one-liners. We're going to have lots of links and stuff. You can subscribe to our podcast on the website, thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, what you want us to discuss in future episodes by dropping us a line at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au, or you can join our conversation on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or Discord chat, and you can find the links in the show notes or on our website. Remember that this is a uniquely Australian podcast, and we think that's an idea worth getting behind. So tell your friends about it and share the episode and tell us what you think of each episode. Before we go, it's time for shout outs.
Once again, Praetorian Studios, working hard. All power to you.
Mark.
Shout out to my beautiful wife, Janet.
Oh, well, mine's along similar lines. My wife and my long-suffering family who've been putting up with me working too hard. I hope to repay your patience very soon. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.